Sure, that's exactly right.
Somehow the Bible contradicts science, or science contradicts the Bible.
Yeah, so that was one of the big points we discussed, that there's this supposed conflict between religion and science, and this assumption that if you're a science-thinking person, you won't be a religious person, and if you're a religious person, you won't be a scientific kind of person. And that really is a conflict. I gave several examples in my own experience last time, you know, going to college and various professors from various disciplines making sure to make a point that if you wanted to be a science-thinking person, that you'd have to give up some of your religious ideas. Just the other day, I had an experience at work that was really interesting. I was talking. I've told part of this story. It's a friend of mine from work. He's a really good guy. I asked him about his religious beliefs, and here was his initial answer that I didn't tell you last time. His initial answer was, and he didn't mean this. He didn't mean this in an offensive way at all. He didn't mean this in an arrogant way at all. He just meant this in the most matter-of-fact way. What he said was, "Well, Tad, you know that I'm a really intellectual person, a real logical thinker." And then he said, "I'm sure you know why that makes religion a problem for me." Isn't that an interesting thought? You know, there's a lot of people that think that way. There's a lot of people that think that you can't be a logical person and also be a religious person. In his mind and in the mind of a lot of people, in order to be religious, you just have to like give up being intellectual. You just have to give up being a logical thinker. God never asks us to do that. He doesn't ask us to do that about anything, and he certainly does not ask us to do that in the context of creation and how we might understand the theory of evolution. So that was basically what we talked about last week. And I also talked about how this clearly does have an effect on our children. And to me, really, that's the main thing I want you to know. Tonight, we're going to talk for about a half an hour about various issues that I think we should have with evolution as Christians. But really, that is not so important to me as all of us as a church and as parents, as grandparents, as friends, appreciating that teaching on evolution has a serious effect on the faith of our children, or it can. And I talked about some studies and statistics that really indicate there's a whole lot of kids, at least in denominational churches, there's a whole lot of kids that just give up on church when they get to college, and at least the reason they put on a piece of paper is in their own minds, they're taught to think in college, they're taught to appreciate things like evolution, and therefore they give up on religion. They learn to appreciate science, and therefore they think they have to give up on Christianity. And that's a problem. And we've got to make sure that we don't have that problem in our church with our children. So, tonight we're going to talk about some meatier things. Some basic arguments, some basic issues that we as Christians can present in defense of Christianity and objecting to traditional teachings on evolution. I can't speak for everyone, but I can speak for myself in saying that the basic teachings on evolution that exist in the world, I don't agree with. I don't agree with. And part of it is because they disagree with the Bible. And part of it is because I think there's a lot of flawed science. So, as we start this discussion about evolution and creation, how they agree or disagree, and where you should stand as a Christian, I just want you to think about this. I'm trying to make this as simple as possible. We'll get into some meatier things, like I said, but this is simple things that anyone can understand. So, an assumption of evolution. An assumption of evolution is that life emerged spontaneously from non-life, right? That you had something on this planet that was not alive, and then it became alive, right? That's an essential assumption of evolution. Anybody ever seen that happen? Anyone ever in the history of humanity seen that happen? No one's ever seen that happen. That's an essential assumption of evolution, and yet time after time after time, through all these years, no one's ever actually observed it. So that's something to keep in mind. Not only has it never been observed, there's not really any good reason to think that it happened. So in science, we call this abiogenesis. Abio means the creation of life from non-life. Genesis, creation, bio, life, a, non, right?
The creation of life from non-life. Never been observed, never happened, and yet that's an essential assumption of evolution. So at a bare minimum, we can say that this pillar in the theory of evolution, we don't know if that ever happened. We've never seen it happen. We don't know if it ever happened. Okay, here's another one. Another essential assumption in the theory of evolution. Humans have existed for 6 million years. That's an assumption. There's nobody around from 6 million years ago to tell us whether or not that actually happened. But that's an assumption. 6 million years. But here's a fact. Here's a fact. Human history only exists for about 6,000 years. That's a fact that everyone can agree on. That's a fact that we can all agree on, and yet evolution asks us to believe this assumption that humans have been around for 6 million years. Again, does that prove evolution wrong? No, but it creates this issue that has to be dealt with. Another assumption.
And how do we know that human history exists for only 6,000 years?
Writings. So, looking at human artifacts, we don't have any human artifacts before about 6,000 years. We don't have any human writings, monuments, anything like that before about 6,000 years ago. Yeah, and really, it's not even quite 6,000 years. The earliest human writing is cuneiform tablets from the Middle Eastern area that's from about 5,000 years ago. And then other evidence of human civilization, which, again, this actually kind of supports what the Bible says, comes from no later than about 6,000 years ago. So again, I think this contrast is pretty valuable. We've got the assumptions that are essential to the theory of evolution on the left, but then observed facts, things that really aren't that contestable, on the right. Oh man, I got to know myself. Okay, so another assumption. Genetic mutation led to more advanced organisms. We'll talk about this later on, but one of the key points of evolution is that once we got this life that came from non-life, that came out of nowhere for no reason apparently, then it started advancing. Over the eons, this life mutated and eventually spread out into the tree of life that exists today, right? So that's an assumption of evolution. Well, how did that happen? Evolution says that that happened through genetic mutations. All living things are created through a biological code that we call DNA, right? It's kind of like a computer code. The computer code for all living things is DNA. For very simple life forms, that DNA is very simple. It's still more complex than anything that human beings have ever created, but the simplest life forms have very simple DNA, and evolution assumes that through the process of random mutation, life became more advanced. But that's the assumption. The observation, though. Have you ever heard of anyone saying, hey, I've got this genetic mutation and it's great? And it's great, and I'm better because of it, and I expect future generations to be better because of it. No, you don't observe that. And so, again, you've got this assumption that is in conflict with observed facts. Genetic mutation in our observation does not lead to good things. It almost always leads to bad things. Something else to think about. I wouldn't really call this a pillar in evolution, but it's still an idea that we have to deal with, right? Dinosaurs died millions of years before human beings. There are no human beings from millions of years ago to tell us absolutely for certain whether or not that's true. So no matter how far science takes us, that will always only be an assumption. Even if it's based on scientific data, that's always only going to be an assumption. So that's the assumption. But an observable fact is that historical records are filled with dinosaur-like creatures coexisting with human beings. That's a fact. Where do you think all these dragon legends came from? I mean, think about a dragon. What is a dragon? It's a really large reptile with big teeth, and they're scary, right? Doesn't that kind of sound a little bit like a dinosaur? Where did all those legends come from? My belief is those legends originated in real interactions between human beings and dinosaurs. And that's not so crazy. I mean, you can open up the book of Job, and we'll do this a little bit later, but you can open up the book of Job, and you'll read about some creatures that don't sound like anything that's alive today. And an honest person will read that and say, that sure sounds like a dinosaur. But then a scientific person will say, well, it couldn't be a dinosaur. It couldn't be a dinosaur. So we'll get to some of those other things later, but those are the basic
a very basic approach to, I think, presenting a case against the traditional view of evolution. It's based on a lot of assumptions that can't be proven. I'm not saying that they're completely outrageous. I'm not saying that evolution is not based in science. I'm saying there's a lot of things about evolution that are based in bad science. And there's a lot of things in evolution that conflict with pretty simple observations. Pretty simple observations. Any questions or comments on that, Ben?
So, one other assumption that you might be able to list there is that the way things are now, as far as like processes and the time it takes things to change, you know, that has remained constant.
Yeah.
And that's why we get to arguments that it takes millions of years for certain things to happen, because, you know, something observed now, well, you know, this thing, it takes this long to decay, and therefore, you know, we follow it back. So the assumption, there's no, the variables don't cause things to change.
Yeah.
And I guess what I'm speaking about is carbon dating.
Sure, things like that. Yep, very good point. So if there's nothing else on this overview, I do want to go ahead and talk about some more specific issues that I have with the idea of evolution. So one of the basic assumptions of evolution that we talked about is that life emerged from non-life. There's really no way of getting around it. And just to show you how much of a problem this is, this idea of life coming from non-life, at one time, there was a growing idea that maybe life on Earth didn't emerge from non-life. Maybe it came from somewhere else. Like maybe there's like this asteroid that had life on it and it landed on Earth. People actually used to teach that because it was such a problem trying to come up with reasons of how life came from non-life. So this individual says something that I think is pretty interesting that describes one of the biggest issues that we should have with evolution. So this chemist, Ilya Prigogine, or whatever their name is, they're important. I apologize to them for not knowing how to say their name. This is what they say. The statistical probability that organic structures and the most precisely harmonized reactions that typify a living organism would be generated by accident is zero. Another example that relates to the statistical improbability of life is an example. I don't remember the name of the scientist I heard say this, but it was in an interview with Ben Stein, who's a proponent of creation. And anyway, this person asked Ben Stein, or Ben Stein asked this scientist, they said, so let's use cars as an analogy. Let's say that Darwin's view of a cell was kind of like a Honda Civic. Let's say that that's what his view of a cell was. What kind of car would you compare our understanding of a cell to today? You see what he was asking? He's basically saying, like, how much more complex is a cell, a living thing? How much more complex is it than Charles Darwin understood? You know what that guy's answer was? You can't even compare it to a car. It'd be like a solar system, is what he said. That's how much more complex things are. Let me give you an example, a statistical example of the improbability of life. So if life really did come from nowhere, it obviously took a series of events to make that happen. Nobody knows what that series of events was, but let's say there was a series of events that made that happen. And we'll just say 10 to put a number on it. We'll say there were 10 events that had to happen in a row to make life happen. And let's put a probability on each of those. And we're going to say it's 1 in a million. Is everybody following me so far? So say we got 10 events in a row, and the probability of each of those events is 1 in a million, which isn't that improbable, right? There's lots of things that have a probability of 1 in a million, and it happens to people, right? So a probability of 1 in a million isn't that improbable. 1 in a million, series of 10 things in a row. So that doesn't sound that unreasonable. But let me write on the board what the probability of that would be. Maybe some of you have seen this example before. The probability of 10 spontaneous events happening in sequence, and if each individual event has a probability of 1 in a million. This is the probability of that happening.
don't even know if that number has a name. And I'm not sure if I got all the zeros up there, but it should be a 1 followed by 60 zeros. I think it's good for us to appreciate that. And that's why this physical chemist says that the probability of life just emerging from non-life and all of the physical processes that it takes for that to happen is zero. That number is essentially zero. And I think it's important for us to appreciate how improbable it is that life came from nowhere. To give you an example, has anyone ever seen this example before? Some of you may have. Maybe, I think I talked about this at Summersville when we were over there for the singing. This is a simple example that anyone can understand about the improbability of life emerging on its own. Take a birdhouse kit, you put it in a box. And that birdhouse kit is supposed to represent all of the things that it takes to make a living cell. A simple one, right? A real living cell, even the simplest cell, has billions upon billions of molecules that all have to fit together in perfect order. Billions upon billions of chemical reactions that all have to be taking place in the appropriate sequence, right? So, if nature could do that on its own, spontaneously, without any organization, without any direction, it should be pretty simple for a birdhouse, which really only has a few pieces, to be spontaneously assembled by nature, right? So the experiment is you put a birdhouse kit in a box and you just set it outside and wait for nature to build it. You wait a million years, what are you going to have? You're still going to have a box with pieces of a birdhouse. So let's say you help nature out a little bit. Say you take that box with the birdhouse kit, and let's say you even help it out a little bit. Let's say you pre-drill all the holes. Maybe even like put a hammer or something in the box. And then you shake the box. How long would you have to shake the box for the birdhouse to spontaneously assemble itself? It won't happen. There's a chance that maybe after a few thousand years, and maybe even not even that long, that you might actually get like a screw or a nail to land in the right spot on the board, right? That might happen. But as far as everything assembling itself, it wouldn't happen, right? We understand that. And yet, the science of evolution expects us to believe that something infinitely more complex assembled itself. I'm going to skip forward to some of the more interesting stuff. Let's talk about genetic mutations for just a minute. So I told you that one of the main tenets of evolution is that over the course of time, random genetic mutations have advanced species. Now, obviously, that would take a lot of time, and that's part of the reason why it's necessary for the world and this universe to be millions of years old. But the assumption is that random genetic mutation is what caused one species to evolve into another species and to evolve into another species. So fortunately, something like this is fairly testable. And science has done this. Take a really simple species, encourage genetic mutation, and then just see what happens, right? See what kind of like new advanced thing that species is capable of. So there were some scientists that tried this. They took some very simple yeast cells, 60,000 strains of yeast, and each of those strains of yeast were designed with their own mutation, just random mutations. They took this simple yeast cell, mutated it with 60,000 different mutations, and let me just read to you the way that they describe the results of their research. They say, "We pitted 60,000 mutated yeast strains against each other in the fight for survival. Those that survived were able to produce more copies of themselves and dominate the population." They say, this is evolution in action. Okay, so that's what they're trying to do. They're trying to replicate the process of evolution. So, which strain of yeast won? The researcher explains, cells without any mutations fared the best and reproduced faster than any of the mutated strains, which tells us that this particular gene has been optimally configured by evolution. You see how that's a kind of a backwards conclusion?
As a Christian, you look at that and you say, well, obviously God designed this strain of yeast to be perfectly suited for its environment. You couldn't mutate it to make it better, right? But someone who buys into the idea of evolution, their assumption is, well, apparently it's just, you know, evolved to this point and we can't make it any better. Clearly disagrees with the idea of evolution. Two more things I want to talk about tonight. The same friend that asked me, or that I asked about his religious views, and he gave me the answer about how, you know, he felt like logic and being intellectual was at odds with being a Christian. The same person before that conversation asked me another question. He asked me if I'd ever thought about metaphysics and how that related to free will. And I don't know why, but I actually had thought about that. And the answer I gave him, because here's what he was getting to. What he was questioning is whether or not free will could be real. And when I say free will, I just mean, you know, human beings having a conscience and having the ability to make their own decisions. And his question was, you know, is that actually possible from a physical standpoint? And what do you think? Is it possible from a physical standpoint? If you as a human being are just made up of set of chemical interactions and electricity running through your body, I mean, do chemicals and electricity, do those things put together have the ability to make decisions on their own? Of course not. Of course not. But from an evolutionary standpoint, that's where we are as human beings. We're really just a really complex assembly of chemical bonds with electricity running through our bodies. And so a man by the name of Dr. Jerry Coyne said this about free will. The ineluctable scientific conclusion is that although we feel we're characters in the play of our lives, rewriting our parts as we go, in reality, we're puppets performing scripted parts written by the laws of physics. And the answer that I gave my friend is that if God doesn't exist, and if something like evolution is true, then this kind of statement is absolutely correct. Because molecules, atoms, and electricity can't have a mind. And yet we do have a mind. And yet we're here thinking about it and talking about it and questioning the reason for our existence. Okay, one more thing to end on, which everyone will appreciate. Does anybody know what that is? It's a moth. But if you were a bird wanting to eat that moth, what would it look like? Maybe something other than a moth, right? Kind of looks like some kind of mammal. Kind of looks like some kind of, I don't know, a raccoon or something. This is just a simple example that I really appreciate. I wouldn't really call this a principal argument against evolution, but I want you to think about what evolution is asking you to believe. All through nature, we have examples of something that's called mimicry. Everybody knows what mimicry is, right? Mimicry is a creature in nature that, for the sake of its own survival, looks like something else, right? And I worded that carefully because someone who believes in evolution would say, well, these animals evolved the characteristic to survive in their environment, and so they look like their environment. I asked Nate what this was. Anybody know what that is? What's it look like? Nate, what's it look like? It sure looks like a snake, doesn't it? And predators who might want to eat this thing would think it's probably a snake. But it's not a snake, is it? If you look at it carefully, it's actually just a caterpillar. And on the rear end of the caterpillar, it has a head that looks exactly like a snake. And evolution, the theory of evolution, asks you to believe that that happened completely, randomly, spontaneously by accident. That this caterpillar formed a posterior that looks exactly like a snake. That feels a little unbelievable. Here's another good example. I'm pretty sure that this bug is called a leaf bug. Any guesses why? Because it literally looks exactly, I mean exactly, like the leafy environment that it lives in. Even the veins running, I mean, some you may not even be able to see this. This right here, this is a bug. If you can't tell, this is a bug all the way down. All this other stuff is leaves, and this is a bug that, according to people who believe in evolution, through the course of millions of years, evolved to look exactly like the leafy environment that it lives in. To me, that's almost, it's a little outrageous, to be honest. Here's another example. Does anyone see the little critter in that picture? What is it? I don't think it's a chameleon, but you're on the right track. It's a lizard, and it's actually a gecko. I don't remember what this gecko is called. It's probably called something like the dead leaf gecko. Because, again, that's exactly what it looks like. And just think about this for a second and let it sink in. Let it sink in. Evolution asks you to believe that this gecko, over the course of millions of years, spontaneously, for no reason whatsoever, with no guidance, with no design, with no exterior forces pressing on it, that over the course of time, this gecko just randomly and totally by chance evolved in such a way that it looks exactly like a dead leaf. Obviously, there's a benefit to this for the survival of the gecko. One more picture. This is one of my favorite ones. That's a moth that looks exactly like the end of a broken stick. And that's pretty impressive. I mean, everything about it. The coloration, the ring around the head, everything about it makes it look like the end of a broken stick. Evolution asks you to believe that that happened completely by coincidence. That it just happened through a series of random mutations that moth evolved in such a way that it looks exactly like a broken stick. So hopefully that's interesting to you. Again, if there's anything to remember, remember those basic arguments about evolution and creation. And remember that it is very important that we don't dismiss this conversation when we're talking to our friends and talking to our children. Ben, you have a closing number?